I've spent most of my career as a system administrator. That's been my first love. And then probably about 13 years ago, I started doing release engineering for a variety of reasons. And now that's my second love, and the two kind of pair well together. I went to go work at Google because I had been a release engineer at several different startup companies. And I found that I was using the same tool set to solve the same problems over and over again. And I thought, you know, I'd like to think differently about this, to see if I could find a better way to do things. And then when the opportunity to work at Google came up, I thought, you know, it would be really great to go and learn about scalability. And I had no idea. And so I'm going to talk today about, well, first of all, what problem are we trying to solve? This slide has nothing new on it for any of you. We've got bottlenecks, latency, machines offline, network partitioned networks, and having to deal with concurrent writes. And so one way that we have solved this problem is with our proprietary package manager that we named Midas, or we most commonly call MPM. And the package metadata is stored in our Bigtable database, and we've written papers on Bigtable. It's a three-dimensional database, and so there's information available. In fact, there's a Wikipedia entry for it. The package data is stored in our Colossus file system, which is our proprietary file system. And that's one of the interesting things about working at Google is it's almost all proprietary software. And so it's interesting because we can really think about the problems that we're solving using our own proprietary software. And our transport mechanism is actually based on Torrent, because Torrent's very fast, it's a peer-to-peer system, and that's our underlying transport mechanism. And this talk does not apply to the Android operating system. This is not how we do updates to Android, and this is not how we do Android app packaging. So just to give you all some context, this really the information in this talk really applies to our file system, our machines that are running Google Web Search, Gmail, and so forth. Basically, all the cloud computing applications. So just a brief summary of what we mean by a package. And there's the contents, in other words, really the files that you're trying to distribute. We have a unique version ID, and it's a secure hashtag. It's quite long, but it's guaranteed to be unique, and it's one of the things that actually allows us to guarantee that packages have not been tampered with, because the hashtag is computed from information about the package. And if any of that information is changed, then the version ID is no longer correct. And if the version ID gets changed, if we recompute it, then we would be able to detect the tampering as well. We also have signatures. Packages can optionally be signed. And so you can request a package that's been signed by a particular user ID. And and you only get packages that have been signed by that user ID. And we have a concept of labels, which I think is unique to our package manager. It's basically just a tag that you can apply to packages. And I'll talk a little bit about how we leverage the use of labels. And then just like most packages, we have optional pre and installation commands that can be run when we install packages. So that's just some basic information so that we're all talking about the same thing. So here's a case study. We have configuration files that we need to distribute to hundreds of machines every 10 minutes. These configuration files are basically tarred and gzipped and stored in a NPM package. And then we have jobs on remote machines that fetch new versions of the package every 10 minutes. So basically, within 10 minutes, every 10 minutes we can push out hundreds of changes to hundreds of machines. And we have a post-fetch script that installs the configuration files. Now, that seems pretty easy, right? I mean, there's nothing really complicated about what we're trying to do, but the fact that it works not only to hundreds of machines, but if you add another zero or another two zeros onto that, it just works in our environment. Feel free to ask questions. That doesn't distract me. Some assumptions and constraints, and there again, this is nothing unique to Google. There's always going to be machines offline. So how do you guarantee consistency when those machines come back online? You want to minimize bottlenecks. We've got this 10-minute window that we're dealing with, and we don't want to be waiting to get the changes pushed out. Jobs need to be able to specify which version of a package they want. And jobs on the same machine might actually use different versions of the same package, and we need to be able to support this in our infrastructure. And we have to be able to guarantee that the files have not been tampered with. And finally, we want to be able to roll back to a previous version. If we start doing what we call a fetch, and we run into problems, we want to be able to abort that and go back to a known good version of a package. So let's talk a little bit about package creation. And I'm going to tie all this back into, you know, the problem that we're trying to solve with maintaining consistency as we go along. We have a package definition file, and this is comparable to an RPM spec file, if you're familiar with RPM. It's information about what's going into the package, the list of files, file ownership and permission, any post or pre-fetch commands that need to be run. And this package definition file is actually generated automatically from our build system. We have a few projects that have static package definitions that are chucked into our source code repository, but probably 99% of them are generated from build rules. So basically, to create a package is pretty simple. You just run a build command, and the package gets created. And then you can label a package at build time on the command line, or you can label the package later, and you can add really as many labels as you would like to a package. One thing that allows us to be scalable is that if the contents of a package, and this is particularly important for things like configuration files, if they haven't changed, we don't actually create a new package. The package NPM is smart, the server is smart enough to realize, oh, this is exact, through the use of checksums, these files have not changed. So therefore, it doesn't create a new package. What it does is any labels you're requesting get applied to the version ID of the package that already exists. So this means there's no new package to replicate, there's no new packages to have to fetch. So for something like configuration files, this is very useful. For binaries, it's not quite as useful because we embed build labels into our binaries. And so every time you do a build, because a timestamp is part of the build label, we're going to get a new package. But certainly for configuration files or data files that don't change very often, this is a very powerful feature. So there's metadata, which kind of describes a package, and then there's the package data itself, which at the heart of it is the files that you're distributing. So we've got two types of metadata. We have immutable data that can't be modified once the package is created. Who built the package, what time, how was the package built? Because we have more than one way to build. We have a couple different commands you can use to build the package, so we track that. What files are in the package, the checksums, the sizes of the files. We do have some labels that are immutable and cannot be modified. And then the unique version ID that I talked about earlier, the hashtag that uniquely defines a package. And then we have mutable metadata. Labels. Most labels can be moved from packages. An example, following through from the previous talk, is you might have a canary label. And when you apply the canary label, it gets moved from the previous canary version of a package to the label you to the package you just indicated. And so everybody knows, oh, if I fetch the canary version of a package, I'm going to get the one that's been targeted as a canary. And likewise, we use a live label to indicate this is the package that has gone through the release process. This is the one that's blessed. It's been thoroughly tested. If you fetch a live version of the package, you're getting a known quantity, and it's okay to fetch it into a production environment. We also have a cleanup policy. We, as we'll talk about, we generate a lot of packages, and there's a lot of data, and we don't want them laying around. And the cleanup policy can be edited so that if you generate a package and you decide later you want to change the cleanup policy associated with that package or groups of packages, you can do so. Because cleanup policies are inherited, actually, from other packages. So, related to tying into that, we do garbage collection automatically. And we've got three kinds of durability of packages. Going back to our case study of configuration files, we have ephemeral packages. And these are short-lived packages. Usually for configuration files or data, that's either going to be generated very frequently or it's going to change frequently, so they don't need to sit around for days and days and days. This saves on storage resources because the packages don't, I mean, these, you know, you think we're generating a new package every 10 minutes over a period of a week. That's a lot of packages. We don't need, and we're not going to fetch one of these packages from 7 days ago. And so we automatically delete the packages. 2 days is actually the default time on our ephemeral packages. Then we have durable packages, which is what we use to push our binaries. They're long-lived, and the default retention time is, retention policy is 3 months since the last time the package was fetched. We have auditing capabilities, and we know who and when when they fetched packages. In fact, one of the projects I worked on for fun, we looked it up. It's last time it was fetched was 4 years ago. We have a job in that's using this package. It's 4 years old. And we'll talk about how that can happen in a minute. And then we have test packages. And these are great for developers if you want to just test from end to end that your package definitions are correct. Because there again, remember, the package definition is part of the build system. There are build rules in our build files, which are like make files, only we have our own proprietary language. And so test packages are treated, they're very short retention, and they're great for doing testing. That's the name. So now let's talk about package distribution. We've talked about some characteristics of packages and how we create packages. We use a pool model. So the pros of this is we can avoid network congestion. We don't have lots of packages being created at the same time and being pushed to a lot of different machines. Job owners can decide when they want to accept a new version. Well, the disadvantages of a pool model is that job owners can decide when they want a new version of a package. So, like, I have this one version that's 4 years old that somebody's still running, and I'd really like for them to upgrade it, but I don't have control over that, and the version they're using is working fine for them. So we need to have extra logic on the machines to check for new. Yes?
What do you do about security patches?
What do we do about security patches? We do have capabilities to restart jobs remotely. Right. We have the ability to do that. But that's like a whole different talk. Yes?
What is your package version strategy?
Oh. That's a good question. Really, it's through the use of our labels. We went through a very interesting second generation of this package manager 2 years ago. The previous version, every time you generated a new package, you got a new integer number associated with the package. And people got used to saying, oh, I'm going to use version 200, I'm going to use 201. Now, the thing that uniquely defines the package is the hash. And it's, I forget how many characters are in the hash. It's like 20 or 21 numbers. So it's not something that you're going to easily reference the package by because it's cumbersome. But technically, it makes sure that the package is unique. And when you reference the package ID, you're getting the one that you mean. So we use labels. And it's really up to the project on how they want to do their labeling. We have I work in our infrastructure organization, and I support several hundred different projects. And we probably have several hundred different packages. I'm exaggerating a little bit. But we do have different packaging labeling. And we have a special label called Latest, which gets you the latest version of a package, and that's something that can't be changed. Every time a new package is created, and we have package names, and that's why I actually don't have an example of package names, but let's say my/package. Every time you create a new version of my/package, a special label called latest gets applied, and so you can fetch the latest package and get the newest one. Well, the problem with that is you don't know who else has created a version. Maybe the developer is doing some testing of their changes to the build file rules, and they want to generate a new package. So our build system, anything that goes to production, goes through a formal release process, and we apply versions to the package. And then we have configuration files that actually parallel the version numbers. And like I said, different teams do it different ways. But the good thing is that we can trust our package management system. We can trust the servers, and I'm going to talk a little bit. I'm getting ready to talk about how our underlying system works and allows us to actually trust. I think that may have answered. Yes, I can repeat the question if you don't want to go. The question was, how important is trust in this environment? Trust is important, but we don't assume trust. And I'm actually going to talk about security in a little bit. So if I don't answer your question, re-ask the question. Yes, please.
Can you get a conflict in the packaging label?
No.
If two organizations want to use the same label, is that a problem?
We have an access control list. I'm going to talk about that when we get to security, on who actually can generate packages, who owns specific labels. We can actually put an ACL down to the label using it's a glob. And so we can prevent that from happening. Basically, you get an error if you try to specify a label that's already been used. So there may be some coordination that's needed. Our build system generates labels automatically. And so we have a guarantee that the label has not been used because of the way that we generate our build labels by the build system. But there again, some people use custom build labels, and they're allowed to do that. And yeah, they may specify, if they're using something like 6.2, that may have already been used by somebody, and they're just going to have to specify a new one. Okay, I guess the last point here is sometimes it's difficult who's going to tell who's going to use a new version. You push your new version out, and actually there's nothing to prevent jobs from picking up the canary version if they decide they want to live dangerously and do that. The metadata. Remember, the metadata is information that really describes the package. It's not the package data itself. It's stored in our big table database, which is a three-dimensional database. Like I said, there's papers that have been written about Big Table. Big Table's replicated throughout our very largely geographic network. We have NPM root servers that can read and cache data from their local Bigtable. Remember, the metadata is going to be replicated through Bigtable, and then the NPM servers themselves are going to read the data from their local Bigtable. The NPM client, which from in its most basic form is just a command called NPM that's being run on a machine, either by a person or by automatically by a job. There's an API as well. It queries its local NPM root server. If it cannot talk to its NPM server, or its NPM server has not been able to get information, it can't talk to its Bigtable server, the local ones, the NPM will automatically fail over to another NPM root server. It's transparent. You might, if you're typing on the command line, you might notice the slight, you know, might take longer than normal to return. But the failover happens on the client side, and it happens automatically. I mean, at some point, if we lose enough Bigtables, or if we lose enough NPM servers, we'll declare a catastrophe. I'm not sure that's ever happened since I've been there. But it could happen, and we're set up to handle it if it does happen. Okay, package distribution. So that's the metadata. So when you go to, when you run your NPM client, and let's say you want the live version of a package, it's going to go to the NPM root server to find out what's the version ID of the live package. And then it's going to go to our Colossus file system. And we have a replication system for Colossus. It's two-tiered. We copy, when we start doing what we call replicating a package, it starts to get copied at geographically strategic data centers. And then it will be copied locally to key Colossus servers at the data centers. So this complete replication can take a while, but as soon as you type that NPM command and you get a carriage return and a success, you know, no errors, your package is available. So if someone goes to fetch that package, they're going to get the latest one. Now, if the package hasn't been replicated locally to the machine that's to the data center where the we're doing the request, there's going to be a delay as the replication gets forced and you get the package. But you're basically, the information and the metadata gets pushed out immediately, so you know whether or not you're getting the latest version of the package. Like I said earlier, fetches are done using a TTorrent-like protocol that we've modified. We have to modify everything. Package data gets fetched to local disk. It's stored on the disks of the machines, and it's very resilient to outages. If you try to do a fetch and you can't, you know, it can use the latest version because you've already got it fetched to disk. This is very scalable. We do millions of fetches a day, and this is fetching petabytes of package data a day, and it works, you know, it works very well. I'm very impressed at how it works, and it's reliable. So let's talk about security. So we have access control lists, and there's three levels of access control lists we have associated with a package or a hierarchy of package. I talked about a package named my/package. I can have my/small package, my/big package, and I can apply a access control list to just my. And that means all the packages under the hierarchy will inherit the access control list, and then you can override individual ACLs on individual packages if you want to. So the management of it is very easy and very scalable. You don't have to go, every time you create a new package, you don't have to create an access control list. You can simply inherit the parent. So an owner can do anything to a package. You can create a package, delete a package, modify labels on a package, create new ACLs. A builder can only create packages and modify labels unless an access control list explicitly denies them the ability to do that. And so a builder has less access to a package than the owner does, or at least setting up how the package is created. And then a label, and I think this ties back to one of the other questions, is who can control or modify specific labels. So often for our build system, we will say, okay, we want production dot to be, production, basically production star, production dot star, to be restricted to the accounts that are allowed to do builds. And this is going to prevent just anybody from creating a package, throwing a production label on it, and the package ending back out into production inadvertently. Canary. I talked about using Canary. We have labels that can't be changed. And the syntax we chose for that is we put an equal sign in the label. And so there are some cases where you apply a label to a package and you don't want that label to be moved to another package for specific reasons. I don't have a lot of projects that do this, but I do have a few. Encryption. We can encrypt individual files, and that's done with a build rule that gets built into the, this information gets put into the package definition when it's generated. And you can, associated with that is which files are encrypted, who is allowed to decrypt the files. The way our file system works is anybody in the company can read files out of the file system. And this gives us the ability to control who can have access to sensitive files. If we have a password, a database password, for example, we need to distribute, we can encrypt it, put it into a package, and only specific users are allowed to decrypt it. The encryption is performed locally on the disk when you package up the machine. When you package the file, not on a server. So basically, if you're physically on your machine and you're running the encryption command, you can pretty much, the network has to trust you who you say you are. And so we don't have to trust the server because the encryption is being done locally. When you fetch the file, you're going to be authenticated and determine if you have the right to read the contents of that file, and then the NPM client will decrypt the file locally using, we have a secure key store server. And I'm not a security expert, so I probably can't go into a lot more detail, but we do have quite a few packages that you take advantage of this capability. Signatures. Yes?
I'm trying to make you go back a slide.
No problem.
I'm just curious. One of the things that's difficult about ACL systems is being able to sort of have a human understand it, or forcing a human to go through and create a mental model of what's going on in that ACL. Do you guys have tools that make it easy for you to understand what you can do, what you're fetching, and what, you know, what these ACLs mean in a practical sense?
I think the question is, do we have tools that help us understand what the ACLs do? Not really. When you run the command to modify or create the ACLs, it throws you into an edit window, and there's these nice comments in each section that explain what they do. But that's not what I would call a tool. I mean, I would call a tool is, if I make this ACL change, what's the repercussion of making that change? Yeah, and we don't have anything like that. We there again, this some of these features are less than 2 years old. The package manager has been around. I don't know how long the package manager has been around, but it's been around for quite a while. And we went through a major 8 years. Thank you. And 2 years ago, we rolled out a major rewrite of it, and the ACLs are something that's new. I'll open a feature request with the Midas team when I get back to work. Signatures. Signatures, basically you can create a package. The most secure way is to do it when you create the package. There's a flag you can set to sign the package. You can sign packages later. When I was talking about how the encryption and decryption works, if you do it at package creation time, that's the most secure way to do it because you can be guaranteed that the server hasn't been compromised. I'm not aware of any server compromises since I started working at Google, but it's something we're thinking about, right? We all have to be defensive and think about what could go wrong because there's a chance someday it might. So we generate a signature using the package data and the metadata, including the file checksums. And so basically the signature is very, very hard to spoof. So when I fetch a package, I can say this package needs to be signed, and it usually, the most typical signature type is either from the build system or from an LDRAC group, if you will. And so basically, when you request it, it gets verified that, yeah, the package was signed by the expected signer, all the metadata has not been modified, and that the signature that's generated using the metadata is indeed the same signature that's stored with the package. So we use this quite a bit. So let's go back to my case study with our configuration files that we're pushing every 10 minutes. If the configuration files have not changed, we don't generate a new package. And these packages are ephemeral, so there's no labels. We don't apply labels to ephemeral packages, and that's an efficiency issue. We don't have to store the information, and basically you just fetch the latest version, and that's the special label we talked about. The metadata is written to Bigtable via the Bigtable API, and it's automatically replicated, and it's pretty instantaneous. It's very, very fast. The package data is copied to our Colossus file system and replicated. And like I said earlier, there may be a delay during replication, but the information, the metadata, is going to be available immediately. And if you request the package, it will be copied from the nearest replicated Colossus server, even if that's not the one that's networked geographically where the job is. Let's see. If the job requests a new version of the package, if the package hasn't changed, nothing happens. So not only are we not generating packages we don't need to, we aren't fetching packages we don't need to. And that's done through the use of the unique version ID, not through labels. I can apply a new label to a package, and I can say fetch this new label. Our fetching mechanism is smart enough to realize, oh no, you already have that one. You're not going to trick me. I'm not going to give you a new one. Okay, so here's some features I think that are really cool about what we've done with our package manager. I've been very interested in package managers for some time now. I've worked with a lot of different package managers. The Solaris package manager, RPM, Debian packages, and here's some features we have that I think are really cool, and I'd like to see them in some of the open source package managers. And unfortunately, NPM is so built into our infrastructure, it's not something we can open source. And that's true with a lot of the Google tools. It's like without our infrastructure, it's kind of worthless. But the lessons learned, and I think in some of the features, are worthwhile and something that might make it back into the open source community. We have an NPM diff that I use a lot. I think it's great. When I've written my own build system, one of the things I would always do is run a manifest against what was in my packages to make sure I got the files I was expecting, to make sure that new files weren't showing up unexpectedly, that files didn't get left out accidentally. And NPM diff allows us to do this. I can compare the most recent package against the current live package, for example. And I can get information about sizes. That's something that can be a surprise. Did the package change by, 500 megabytes. Maybe something probably went wrong if that's the case. Did my post or prefetch scripts change? Because that might have an operational impact, and it might be something I want to be aware of or at least be able to communicate automatically. And then file checksums. File checksums isn't quite as interesting for binaries, but for our case study, for the configuration files, that might be interesting. That's going to tell me immediately which files have changed between the two packages. I talked about labels. Labels are just invaluable because it's a whole lot easier and clearer to refer to a package as Fred than it is to refer to, I should have put a copy of our hashtag in here, but it's one dash blah, blah, blah. It's really, they all begin with one for some reason. I'm not sure the technical reason for that. labels are useful for rollback. If you make a package live, the previous live version, you can put a package, you can put a label of previous on it, you can put a label of rollback on it, and then if you have a problem in production, it's very, very quick to quickly roll back to the last known good. That's another good label, last known good. File groups, this is my last point. Files within it, we have file groups, and that's basically a grouping of files within an NPM. And you can have a very common example is that's the way we distribute unstripped binaries. We'll put the stripped binary in the default file group, and we'll put the unstripped binary in a special file group so that if our SREs run into a problem, they can very easily, they know exactly where to go get the unstripped binary that matches the binary that they've already fetched. And you can have files in more than one file group, and they don't get replicated. Each file is only contained in the package once, so it's very efficient. And any more questions? Oh, no, I have one more point. I'm sorry, I have one more point. We have a web interface, too. I'm a command line girl. I'm like NPM, PI, information about the command line. But a lot of my users, when I show them the web interface, they're like, oh, that's so awesome. And then you can go in and browse information. There's graphs that show you the size of your package over time. So you can see what a data hog you're being, because packages never get smaller, right? They only grow. And, okay, question.
For an organization that doesn't have the resources of Google, what are your key points you think need to be applied to CM?
Use your open source tools. Have a consistent naming system for your packages. You need to know what you're installing. I think if you're a small organization, you should just pick a naming convention. Google's very developer oriented, and our developers have a lot of leeway in how they do things, which is why we don't have the same versioning conventions for all of our packages. I think if you're a small organization, you should have a consistent numbering scheme. Depending on what kind, RPM has their own conventions they use. Debian packages is slightly different. Have your build system do some of the things I talked about, doing package checking with a manifest, checking sizes of packages before they get into production. That's a common problem I found is you get a debug instead of a stripped version of a binary out in production, and it's taking up resources. Any checking you can do, and I think this is consistent with the message from the talk I gave before, anything you can prevent, do up front. We treat release engineering as end-to-end. From the point the code is created to the point it goes into production is basically the scope of release engineering. And so we try to make sure that things are done consistently and can be reproduced. so that if you do a build, you can reproduce that build 3 months from now if you need to. So you need a good source code management system that you understand and a branching strategy that allows you to go back and reproduce builds, because you're going to need to at some point in time. I mean, we do continuous pushes all the time. Mostly, not in infrastructure so much, because people don't like it when your infrastructure changes every hour. But certainly things like Google Plus, they do builds every hour. And so the chances of them having to go back to something a month ago is probably pretty slim. So depending on your velocity of your releasing, you should you need to be able to go back and reproduce your builds. First software vendor I ever worked for, we used CVS, and I was not the release engineer. I was in customer support. And we got the situation where we could not reproduce what our customers were running. This was this was really early, and you know, software basically didn't work that well anyway. But you know, and that was a lesson I learned, and I've carried with me for the rest of my career. So I think there's some of the resources. Certainly, some of the talks we heard today, you couldn't get this information 2 years ago. So I think for the small companies, there's a lot of tools that are available, and I think the idea of a community best practices. We have best practices on release engineering within Google, and I think certainly I'd like to see Usenix, I've already been talking to some people about this today, come up with a community best practices that should be tool agnostic. Because not everybody's, and like I said, I've gone from the smallest environment to one of the biggest environments, and I think that's given me a good breadth. At least I hope so. Any other questions? Okay. Oh, one more.
Are there any documents available on the label system, Midas?
Now, this is actually the first time we've talked about Midas outside the company. You know, I would love to do a paper on this. I really would. So hopefully at a future conference, I'll be able to do a technical paper on this. I did work I worked closely with the Midas team on this talk, and they were very excited because this is the first time we've publicly talked about. And I was excited the press team let me say petabytes. Okay. Thank you.